Thanks for downloading this History Hub podcast. For more information on History Hub and to download our other podcasts, go to historyhub.ie/podcasts. In this episode, The Home Rule Party, Lecture 1 of Professor Michael Laffin's 10-lecture series on the Irish Revolution.
Well, good morning. For those of you who don't know me, you've probably guessed already that I'm Michael Laffin. I'm giving this course, running this module on the Irish Revolution. In looking at the Irish Revolution, and it will be mainly a political history course, if only because one of the great paradoxes of early 20th century Irish history is that the Irish social revolution was over before the political and military revolution began. And that's a theme that I'll refer to on some occasions this morning. It is, of course, largely in political history. If you don't like political history, get out now. Well, it's not too late, and move to some other option, some other module. We look at various strands, elements, and developments. Today, I look mainly at the Home Rule Party, the parliamentary party led by John Redmond, the party, the group, the system, the tradition that was destroyed in the course of the revolution. But in the words of one distinguished historian of the period, Paul Bew, now Lord Bew, it is not possible fully to assess the implications of the Easter Rising unless we know more about what was, in Irish domestic political terms, destroyed by it. The Home Rule Party, the Home Rule Movement, was destroyed in the aftermath of the Easter Rising. But we must remember that it was the dominant force in Irish nationalism for decades before that, from the mid-1880s to the mid-1910s. It had a very long innings. And, one might say, it has conditioned the political history of independent Ireland ever since. Many of the habits, for better and particularly for worse, of our leading political parties are inherited from the Sinn Féin Party, which destroyed the Home Rule Party, which in turn inherited them from its enemy, the Home Rulers. So patterns established by Parnell in the 1880s and Redmond in the 1900s are still with us in the 2010s. Today. The Home Rule Party, though it vanished in Southern Ireland in 1918, not in Northern Ireland, is in spirit, in some respects, still with us. In Northern Ireland, it lived on until 1969-1970 under a different name. We'll look at that later. So today, I'm going to look at the Home Rule Party. Don't ever forget that the groups we will concentrate on from the greater part of the course, Sinn Féin, the IRB, the IRA, represented until 1917-1918 only a tiny minority of Irish nationalists. And Redmond and his party was or were the voice of the vast majority of the Irish people, or at least of Irish nationalists. Ever since Parnell established the Home Rule Party in the mid-1880s, it was the dominant force in Irish public life. One had to belong to it if one were to have any chance of getting on in politics. And it was, in some respects, the first modern political party, not just in Ireland, but in the United Kingdom, providing a role model for the Conservatives and the Liberals, which reluctantly and resentfully they followed. It was the first party to be tightly disciplined, to be dominated by its leadership. It did, of course, as we all know, experience a major split in 1890-91. But until then, it was ruled in a way that no British party had been ruled by one man. And some of these autocratic habits survived the split and were reconstituted in a somewhat different form in the two rival Home Rule parties in the 1890s and then the reunited single Home Rule Party after 1900, after the reunification. The party's virtues and vices are characteristic of Parnell and the system that he established in the 1880s. Most of Parnell's lieutenants were able men. And when I refer to men and he, it's not casual sexism. Until 1918, women didn't feature in Irish public life. Women didn't have the vote, couldn't run for parliament. Politics was a man's world. Just bear that in mind. Only in 1918 do, with the exception of Countess Markievicz, only in 1918 do women appear in Irish public life and therefore appear in any significant way in the Irish Revolution. Parnell's lieutenants, who assisted him and carried out his day-to-day business in the 1880s, dominated the party, or the rival factions of it, until 1918. At the highest level, there was no new blood. And young, dynamic figures like John Redmond, John Dillon, William O'Brien, and Tim Healy remained aging by the decade, becoming inevitably more conservative, as people do. I can say that with experience, personal experience. They remained as the leading figures without any significant replacement. Only one exception to that generalisation, a man I mentioned from time to time, Joe Devlin from Belfast, who was young, dynamic, and introduced into the party an element that had been, to its great credit, absent until then, sectarianism. It's interesting that the first three leaders of the Home Rule Party were all Protestants. Isaac Butt, William Shaw, and Charles Stuart Parnell. I pronounce his name Parnell, by the way. He did, so it's reasonable for me to do it. I was directed to do so when I was a first arts student here a very long time ago. Most people, of course, pronounce him Parnell, which is fine. But you will allow me that little eccentricity which he shared. The followers of the party were obedient, unimaginative. They were despised by their British counterparts as lobby fodder who did what they were told and didn't argue in the way that many Conservative and Liberal and later Labour MPs would argue. Some of the characteristics were unaffected by the split of 1890-91. There were differences in principle after that. Do we look for conciliation with Irish landlords, or do we engage in ongoing confrontation with them? Do we commit ourselves wholeheartedly and unquestioningly to the Liberal alliance, or do we flirt, if we can, with the Conservative Party? And this is a key element of the Home Rule movement, the Liberal alliance. Until the mid-80s, Parnell had freedom of manoeuvre. He could and did negotiate with both Lord Salisbury on the Conservative side and Gladstone on the Liberal side. He could, in theory, sell himself and his followers to the highest bidder. And he was worth a lot. He had 85 solid votes in the House of Commons, which meant that either of or both the British parties had to have a majority over the other of 86. Otherwise, Parnell would hold the balance of power. He could and did sell himself. That came to an end in 1885, with the political revolution of that year, when the Liberals under Gladstone committed themselves to Home Rule, and the Conservatives under Salisbury committed themselves against it. Basically, that pattern didn't change until the end of the First World War and the end of both the Home Rule and the Liberal parties. Redmond didn't have the freedom of manoeuvre that Parnell did. Redmond could dictate terms or try to dictate terms to Liberal leaders, but he had nowhere else to go because the Conservatives were even more passionately opposed to Home Rule than the Liberals were committed to it. And the reason was this. In 1885-86, when Gladstone introduced the first Home Rule Bill, the Liberal Party split in three. Gladstone controlled the majority faction in the centre, but the Radicals under Joe Chamberlain on the left and the Conservatives under Lord Harcourt on the right both deserted to the Conservative Party in opposition to Home Rule. And the Conservatives, which had been the minority party in British public life for the previous 40 years, since they had split over the repeal of the Corn Laws, now became the majority party, which they remained for 20 years until 1906. But it was opposition to Home Rule that had made them the majority party, that had brought these defectors from the Liberals. The more they emphasised their hostility to Home Rule, the more united they became. It was a bond that held together disparate groups that might otherwise have drifted apart. Ultimately, to an extent, they did drift apart. Joe Chamberlain who had done so much to split the Liberals in 1886 over Home Rule, allied with the Conservatives and then split them over tariff reform in 1903, ultimately bringing down the Conservative government and bringing the Liberals back. And it was on political events in Britain of that sort that Irish politics depended. When the Liberals were in power, the Home Rulers were happy. There was at least a chance of Home Rule, and after all, the Liberals did introduce three Home Rule bills. And there was a chance of reform. There was a chance of a degree of patronage for their boys. When the Conservatives were in power, as they were almost all the time, after 1886, with the exception of just 3 years, for the next 20, when the Conservatives were in power, there was little to hope for in terms of Home Rule or patronage, but there might be, and there was, something to be hoped for in terms of reform. Because another of the dominant themes of the late 19th, and particularly the early 20th centuries, was the Conservative policy of killing Home Rule with kindness. A far-sighted, imaginative, ultimately unsuccessful, but nonetheless fascinating experiment to try and remove Ireland's grievances. An acceptance by the Conservatives that, yes, the Irish have a case. They might be bloody-minded, they might be rebellious, they might be difficult, they might whinge and whine and complain all the time, but they do have some legitimate grievances. They have been badly treated. They are much poorer than the English, Scots and Welsh. Let's remedy these grievances. Let's give them nothing to complain about. And then they might forget Home Rule, they might become as happy, loyal, contented subjects of her or his majesty as are the English, Scots and Welsh. And the result of that, a series of reforms, some introduced by Liberal governments, but the important ones introduced by Conservative governments. Above all, the great Wyndham, W-Y-N-D-H-A-M, the Wyndham Land Act of 1903, one of the great revolutionary measures in Irish history, which effectively, over a decade or more, transferred the ownership of half the land of Ireland from Unionist, Conservative, largely Protestant, aristocrats or gentry, to Catholic tenant farmers. And that was why I said a few minutes ago that the Irish social revolution was over before the political revolution began. The Land Acts were the Irish social revolution. The land question that had provided the driving force behind much agitation and much nationalism was solved, in effect, with a few exceptions, by the outbreak of the war. And the result of the Land Acts was large numbers of small farmers determined to hold on to the land that they had effectively been given by the British government, because they've paid less in mortgage repayments to the British than they had already paid in rent. They paid less for land that they owned than for land that they earlier hadn't owned. It was a great bargain. No wonder the Wyndham Act, the Wyndham system, was oversubscribed and almost collapsed under the strain of tenant farmers rushing to buy their land. It was a terrific deal, subsidised by the British taxpayer. The result of it, tens of thousands of tenant farmers, small landowners, ex-tenant farmers, deeply conservative, anxious to protect what they had, no longer aggressive, no longer with a grievance, taking the attitude later expressed by Sir James Craig, the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, what we have, we hold. And the Conservatives in London took the view, this act and other such measures have together the potential to make Ireland a deeply conservative country. If only they would stop worrying about Home Rule. And the longer they are accustomed to being contented, happy, satisfied owners of their own land, the less likely it is that they will worry about Home Rule. And this was a serious anxiety for many Home Rule leaders. John Dillon, the deputy leader of the party, far more radical than John Redmond, his nominal superior or boss, John Dillon was deeply concerned that without the land grievance, the Irish people would go soft on Home Rule. They would take the view, we don't need it anymore. All our problems are being solved under the present system. And other problems were being solved too. Again, under the Conservatives in 1898, the Local Government Act transferred the control of local government at urban and county and district level from the gentry to the Irish democracy. And at that level, local government, county councils and lower bodies, at that level, Ireland was a functioning democracy from 1898 onwards. The Irish people had become accustomed to operating a democratic system at local level. The university question that had plagued middle-class Ireland for decades was solved with the National University of Ireland, created in 1908 under the Liberal government. So one by one, the grievances that had characterised or dominated Irish public life for many decades were being solved. Effectively, with the exception of the bitterly contested election of 1892, when Parnellite and anti-Parnellite battled it out, and the Unionists sat back and watched smugly. With the exception of that battle, Ireland tended to be a one-party, not a state, a one-party nation, divided into different areas. In the three southern provinces and parts of Ulster, Ireland was nationalist, was home rule. In parts of Ulster, Ireland was unionist. And I'll talk about the unionists at greater length in a minute. And since there were, in effect, only two parties, wherever there was a Catholic nationalist majority in the population, the Home Rule candidate was returned, often returned unopposed, unchallenged. And the result of this was that in many respects, in many parts of Ireland, there were no elections. Once the Home Rule candidate would have been chosen, nobody would run against him. There would be no point in a unionist fighting him when 95 or 99% of the population was Catholic and nationalist. Similarly, in large areas of Ulster, particularly East Ulster, no point in a nationalist running against a candidate who is destined to get 70 or 80% of the votes. So many seats were uncontested, not just in one election, but election after election, sometimes decade after decade, in a pattern very similar to that that applied in Northern Ireland between 1921 and the 1960s. In 1892, the year in which the two rival factions of Home Rule fought it out, of the 103 Irish seats, 83 were contested. By 1906, the year of the great Liberal victory, only 21 of 103 seats were contested. The remaining 82 had candidates returned unopposed, nationalist or unionist. The figure varied slightly, but it was more or less in that range. And on the side of the Home Rulers, most of the contests they had to fight were not against unionists, because there had been an unofficial demarcation. This is a unionist area, nationalists won't bother, and vice versa. Most of the contests fought by Home Rulers were against rival Home Rulers, against factions led by leaders, dissident leaders, particularly William O'Brien and Tim Healy. And very few MPs were unseated by the party machine. So once an MP was nominated and elected, he often had the job for life without ever needing to bother to fight an election. In one constituency, East Donegal, no election was fought between 1885 and 1918. General elections would come and go, occasional by-elections when an MP would die, the Home Rule candidate would be returned unopposed time and time and time again. So, in that respect, Irish democracy was, you might say, theoretical, rather than a practical aspect of life experienced by Irish voters. And in another sense, Irish democracy was odd, flawed, one might even say somewhat fraudulent. Election after election, from the 1880s to 1910, a large majority of Irish voters voted for Home Rule. They never got Home Rule. Either the Conservatives won an election and decided that's it, we are going to ignore the Irish vote completely and entirely, or the Liberals won an election and weren't able to deliver on Home Rule. As many of you know, I hope the Irish students among you know, in 1886, Gladstone introduced the first Home Rule Bill, which was defeated in the House of Commons, resulting in the fall of his government. He came back to office in 1892, introduced a second Home Rule Bill, which was defeated in the House of Lords, defeated by a margin of 10-1. After that, the Conservatives came back. When the Liberals returned to power, they came to office in 1905 as a minority government and won one of the great election victories in British history in 1906, comparable to 1945 or 1997. They had such a large, overwhelming majority over the Conservatives and Home Rulers and Labour combined that they took the view, there's no need. We love the Home Rulers dearly, but there's nothing we can do. We know very well that the House of Lords, which has a large Conservative majority, will reject Home Rule. So let's not waste our time. Let's introduce other bills. We have a long shopping list of reforms we want to carry out. Let's introduce other bills that will not be subject to the House of Lords veto. Let's be realists. And sooner or later, luck will change. Sooner or later, we will be able to grant Home Rule, but not yet. So, Home Rule seemed to get nowhere, seemed to have no chance of getting anywhere, and yet, and this is the remarkable fact, and yet, Irish voters continued to retain their loyalty in this party that had rarely to fight any elections, at least at parliamentary level, and failed to achieve its one overriding objective, year after year, election after election, decade after decade. The party remained dominant, despite the squalid details of the split. Some of you may be familiar with the taunt of Tim Healy, the scourge of Parnell, in Committee Room 15 in the House of Commons, as the party was about to fall into two rival factions over Parnell's affair with Catherine O'Shea. And you'll note I do not call her Kitty O'Shea. Catherine was her name. And I think it's reasonable and fair and civil and chivalrous to call her by that name. His affair with Catherine O'Shea had split the party because of Gladstone's announcement that he could no longer support an adulterer as leader of the Irish party. There was no concern about adulterers as leaders of British parties. Different standards applied. But in the great debate in Committee Room 15, Parnell, with characteristic arrogance, declared, "The question is, who is to be the master of the party?" Whereupon Healy riposted, "The question is, who is to be the mistress of the party?" It was at that level that the battle was fought. The campaigns were often squalid. The rivalry was intense. And yet, the two opposed factions of the Home Rule Party retained the loyalty of the vast majority of Irish nationalists. And after the party was reunited, interestingly, under the leadership of John Redmond, the leader of the very small minority Parnellite faction, because the larger group, the anti-Parnellites, were so divided among themselves that, as a compromise, they accepted a leader from the other side. But Redmond was always in a weak position, with powerful party bosses or barons unwilling to accept his authority, particularly his lieutenant, John Dillon. The party was, in many respects, democratic, especially after the formation of the United Irish League, which characteristically began its life as an opposition force opposed to the Home Rule Party in County Mayo, spread rapidly, and was taken over by the Home Rule Party, which incorporated it as its own grassroots organisation. The party was, by and large, representative of Irish voters in a way in which British parties were not, at least the two main British parties, the Liberals and Conservatives. Labour was, by and large, representative of its working class support. But the Liberals and Conservatives were led by aristocrats and gentlemen. The Prime Minister until 1902 was Lord Salisbury, who was, I think, the fifth Marquess of Salisbury, the owner of vast estates. He was succeeded as Prime Minister by his nephew. There was an aristocratic element in the Conservative Party that survived long after the First World War, and to a lesser extent in the Liberals as well. Not in the Home Rule Party. There was nothing like it. The Home Rule Party MPs were by and large representative of the dominant element in Irish public life, the ex-tenant farmer, now small farmer. Irish Home Rule MPs were, to an extent, farmers, but less so than one might expect. After all, farmers have to look after the farm. Animals and crops won't tolerate long absences by the person looking after them in Westminster. So it tended more often to be publicans or shopkeepers who were the representatives of the constituencies. At the beginning, in Parnell's time, to save money, he recruited London Irish. Because they lived in London, therefore they had no expenses. Travel expenses, accommodation expenses, and so on. Later, there was a tendency for Home Rule MPs to be constituency-based, to be representative of the interests of their constituents, above all in seeking favours from London or from Dublin Castle for their constituents. A pattern that, as we know, has not yet passed from Irish public life. They were representative of the grassroots, even if some of their leaders could be described as gentlemen. Just to take the most important of them, John Redmond, whose father had been an MP before him, his great uncle had been an MP. The only job he had ever held before he became an MP was to work as a clerk in the House of Commons. Tim Healy became a very successful barrister in London. But these were exceptions. Most of the Home Rule MPs were decent, admirable, unremarkable men, popular in the neighbourhood, who were representative of of their constituents. The party was a catch-all party, non-ideological. It wasn't left or right. It had some left-wing members. It had very many right-wing members and others in between. In that way, it could be compared perhaps with the German Christian Democratic Party. Largely conservative, but with elements that would be regarded with horror by the contemporary Conservative Party in Britain. Or what was, until the 1960s, the catch-all Democratic Party in the United States, which ran from the far left, insofar as there is any left in the United States, to the far right, the racists in the southern states. And since it was a party with, in theory, only one goal, Home Rule, it could and did argue we must subordinate all class conflicts. We mustn't divide ourselves along class lines. Once we get Home Rule, all will be well. Then we will be able to implement our programme. So let's not rock the boat. Let us bury, just for the time being, internal differences. There's no need for a Labour Party. Of course not. We are the Labour Party, just as we are the Conservative and Liberal Party in Ireland. We are every party in Ireland. Once we get Home Rule, then we can afford the luxury of these other groups. And this is one of the many attitudes, and it's a point I mentioned some minutes ago, one of the many attitudes transmitted from the Home Rule Party to its Sinn Féin successor, which was just as determined as the Home Rulers had been to postpone, to bury any class conflict, to maintain a united front in pursuit of the Irish Republic, in the case of Sinn Féin, just as it had been a united front in pursuit of Home Rule in the case of the Parliamentary Party. Another way in which the Home Rule Party was democratic was one that Parnell had begun. He paid his MPs a salary. Some of them were relatively poor, even very poor, and couldn't afford accommodation in London, couldn't afford travel to and from London. They were paid out of party funds. This was regarded with outright disgust by British politicians, particularly Conservatives. The idea that a member of Parliament should be a hireling, a servant of the party boss, whose vote would be conditioned by payment, was demeaning and so typically Irish. Oh, they winced with disgust. Eventually, of course, they followed the Irish example in this, as in so many other ways. Later, in the period of the Irish Revolution, The Home Rulers were widely and bitterly criticised by their Sinn Féin opponents for having been paid £400 a year, a gross and appalling sum, it was argued. But when the Home Rulers were dependent on the party to pay them, they were paid much less than was allowed to all members of the House of Commons. After the Great Parliament Act of 1911, which I'll mention if I have time at the end of today's lecture. And in the last figure, which is available from 1904, 54 Irish MPs were paid an average of £120 a year. It sounds, of course, absurd by modern standards, but remember the impact of inflation. That was a time of no inflation, virtually none. So £120 a year in 1904 was worth the same as it would have been in 1911 when salaries were introduced for all MPs at a very much higher rate of £400. The party's record was in many respects impressive. It did secure or facilitate a substantial range of concessions. The Land Acts, which I've mentioned already, the Catholic University, the Evicted Tenants Act, improvements in urban and rural housing, the application of the Old Age Pension Act to Ireland, which was an enormous social revolution, partly because of Ireland's very different demographic structure from that of Britain, with a larger, older population, and also, crucially, a much later date of registering births than was the case in Britain, which meant that elderly men and women were unable to prove or unable to have disproved their claimed date of birth. And the result was very many people suddenly aged 10 or 15 years with the introduction of the Old Age Pension Act and were in benefit of funds which, had Ireland experienced the sort of registration of births that was the case in the rest of the United Kingdom, and they wouldn't have acquired. Of course the Home Rule Party didn't introduce these bills. In some cases, it was rather wary of them. But naturally, being a level-headed, practical, down-to-earth political party, it claimed credit for them. Some of them might have come anyway. Others, the Land Acts, were undoubtedly hastened by the actions of the Home Rule Party. But one of the vitally important achievements of the Home Rule Party, and it's one that I'll come back to again and again during this course, the Home Rulers committed Irish nationalists to political activity over the decades from the 1870s onwards, even, as I've mentioned, even though their experience of democracy was often more theoretical than real. Constitutional procedures worked their way into Irish people's minds and habits. And when we reach the Irish Revolution proper, I will argue that it was in large part for this reason that ultimately democrats rather than militarists were able to triumph, and Ireland became a functioning democracy after the Civil War, not a military dictatorship or semi-dictatorship as was the case in so many newly independent nations. And many of, as I said already, many of the Home Rulers' customs, habits, procedures were adopted, implemented by their Sinn Féin opponents and by the successors of that Sinn Féin party, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. In some respects, the Home Rule Party's problems by the 1900s and 1910s were those of its success. A.J. Balfour, Prime Minister in the early 20th century, a reforming Chief Secretary of Ireland under the rule of his uncle, the Marquess of Salisbury, his policy of killing Home Rule with kindness might have worked. I think I quoted Dillon or referred to him. Dillon's remark, "The land question is a weapon in nationalist hands. To settle the question finally would risk Home Rule, which otherwise must come." And by the 1900s, particularly after 1906, when the Liberals returned to power, Home Rulers were becoming extremely worried. There is no sign of Home Rule. We have the most friendly leader of the Home Rule Party, the Prime Minister, Henry Campbell Bannerman, former Chief Secretary, but he shows no sign of wanting to do anything. He's quite prepared to drift. He's polite to us, much more polite than his Conservative predecessors were, But there's no sign of Home Rule coming. They, the Liberals, don't need us. And they take the view, quite reasonably, that the House of Lords would reject a bill. What is the point? Augustine Birrell, the longer-serving Chief Secretary of Ireland, from 1907 to 1916, wrote at the beginning of his term of office to Campbell Bannerman and the Prime Minister, "The impression is general in Ireland that the Irish Party, now that is the Home Rule Party, has allowed Home Rule to be snowed under and that it cannot emerge for at least a decade. Were this impression to become a belief," and he underlined those two words, "were this impression to become a belief, Redmond and his whole party would be knocked into space and the Sinn Féiners, who are Fenians and ribbon men and separatists in new clothes and with some new ideas, would reign in their stead." Remarkable prophecy. A very shrewd forecast of what would happen, even though in part it would happen at the expense of Birrell's own career, because he was destroyed by the Easter Rising. The Home Rule Party's dilemma was, it was dependent on the goodwill of the Liberals, of a friendly Prime Minister like Campbell Bannerman, of a much less friendly Prime Minister like his successor Asquith, Asquith, who took over in 1908 and remained as Prime Minister for 8.5 years until the end of 1916, the longest term in 20th century Britain, with the exception of Margaret Thatcher. And Asquith represented the imperialist wing of the Liberal Party, those Liberals who were increasingly unhappy with the Home Rule Alliance, who regarded the Irish as a nuisance, associated the Irish with the bad old days of defeats. Defeat in the House of Commons in 1886, defeat in the House of Lords in 1893. What is the point of ever bothering with the Irish again, especially now when we can do what we like with the largest overall majority that a party has had for decades? We can carry out major reforms. And that government, headed by Campbell Bannerman and then by Asquith, was one of the great reforming governments in British history. It carried out, in some respects, a social revolution, transferring money from the rich to the poor, and incurring the deep, passionate hatred of many conservatives in Britain, in civilian life, and importantly, in a point that I'll come to next week, in the army as well, where the government of Asquith was regarded as the equivalent of being communist Marxist. The term then was socialist, but the taint, the slur, was the same. So, no joy for the Home Rulers. Redmond faced a series of challenges. Splits within the party, defections, criticism from some of his MPs, the formation of a new party that I look at next week, Sinn Féin, led by Arthur Griffith, which challenged him briefly and then disappeared. It was only in 1909 that things began to change, that the prospect of major upheaval in Ireland emerged. And the group responsible for this, the group that triggered the Irish Revolution, was paradoxically the one element in British society most passionately opposed to Irish nationalism and any question of Home Rule, and that was the House of Lords. It is bizarre that it was the House of Lords that began the whole process that resulted in the Easter Rising and the Irish Free State. The background was this. Remember that until after the period I'm talking about right now, every bill introduced in Parliament had to pass both Houses of Parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. Membership of the House of Commons changed with every election. The control of the House of Commons changed from time to time when a different party won a majority. The House of Lords always remained controlled by the Conservatives. And that pattern, which had existed before the great Liberal split of 1886, was intensified by it when the great majority of Liberal members of the Lords deserted and joined the Conservatives. The Conservatives always controlled the Lords, and they could, in theory, reject any bill. Of course, they didn't. They modified bills. They emasculated some of them. But, and some they did reject, like the Second Home Rule Bill of 1893. But they took the view that they couldn't destroy all bills. They had to respect British democracy. They had to respect the wishes of the House of Commons, and they let many bills through with minor modifications. Until after 1906, when they decided that they might have lost the election in the Commons, but they could still rule the country indirectly through the House of Lords. And for the next 3 years, they undermined the Liberal government. They destroyed many of its bills. And the result was increasing rage and frustration by the Liberals, who, despite their large majority, were unable to get some of their measures through. One attitude taken by the Liberals was filling the cup, letting the cup of grievances fill up until it would overflow, and then they could strike. And they struck in 1909. There was a convention in British politics, not a rule, but a convention, that the House of Lords could not reject a budget, because if it did, the government would instantly fall. No government can survive without money to run the country. If a government is defeated on a budget, it collapses, it resigns. In Ireland, we had that experience. None of you, of course, will remember. I do. I'm very old. We had that experience in 1982 when Garrett Fitzgerald's first government fell by one vote over the question of a tax on women's and children's shoes. And, of course, if a government loses a vote of confidence, it has to resign as well. And that happened in Britain in 1979 when James Callaghan's Labour government fell by one vote and Margaret Thatcher won the following election. But the convention, which went back 200 years to the reign of Queen Anne, was that the House of Lords could not reject a budget. A government could be displaced only by the House of Commons or by the electorate, not by the Lords. So in 1909, Lloyd George, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, spell his name properly, L-L-O-Y-D, Lloyd George, introduced into the budget various measures that might normally have been separate non-budget issues, on the assumption that the House of Lords wouldn't dare reject a budget and bring down the government. For months there was tension. Would or would not the Lords take the risk? Would they defy 2 centuries of tradition and bring down a government on a budget? And to the amazement of many people, they did. They rejected the budget. Asquith immediately resigned as Prime Minister and called a general election. And as all the Irish people here know, but some foreigners may not, in Ireland, as in Britain, a Prime Minister can decide, and normally does decide, the date of an election. It's not fixed, as is the case in the United States or in Germany or very many other countries. The Prime Minister says, we will have an election in 3 weeks' time. And Asquith said, OK, we've lost the vote, an election now. The election took place in January 1910, and to his and most people's total amazement, his campaign of the peers versus the people failed. He lost his massive overall majority. There was near deadlock between the Liberals and the Conservatives, and John Redmond was holding the balance of power. After all these years, thank you, House of Lords. Asquith and his colleagues were horrified. The idea of being dependent on a bunch of paddies. Back to the bad old days of Gladstone. The horror of it. Let's not bother. Let's give up. It's not worth it. And there were serious discussions around the cabinet table about handing over power. Let Balfour, the former Prime Minister, still the Conservative leader, let him take office. It's not worth hanging on to power if we are to be dependent on the Irish. Of course, such deeply unpolitical views didn't last. The natural urge, lust, obsession for and with power won out. And Asquith began negotiating with Redmond to do a deal. The negotiations dragged on for months, interrupted by the sudden death of the king, Edward VII, and then they resumed for most of the year. A deal was done. An alliance would be struck. The budget, the people's budget, Lloyd George's budget, had gone through after the election. The House of Lords said, OK, there is, in the new House of Commons, as in the old, a majority in favour of the budget. OK, we let it through. So that was no longer an issue. But the Liberals wanted revenge. They wanted to curb the power of the House of Lords. And for the next 2 years, between 1909 and 1911, British public life was dominated by the struggle between the two Houses of Parliament, the Commons and the Lords. A second election was held in 1910 with exactly the same result as the first. Now there was complete equality between the Liberals and Conservatives. Redmond held the balance of power even more perfectly than before. And in 1911, Asquith introduced the first of the two stages of his deal with Redmond, the Parliament Bill, which became the Parliament Act. And that Parliament Act of 1911 laid down the modern British constitution, which some people say is centuries old. It is not. Next year it will be a century old. The Parliament Act of 1911 was revolutionary. First of all, it limited the time span of a House of Commons. Until then, a House of Commons was elected for a seven-year period, except that it might shorten that period, but it could last for 7 years. Now, that was cut to five. MPs were paid a salary, as I've mentioned already. And the power of the House of Lords was to be restricted. Not only could it not ever again reject a budget, but it couldn't reject ordinary legislation. If a bill passed the House of Commons three times in identical form, those three words are crucial, and I'll talk about them next week. A bill had to pass the Commons in identical form in three successive sessions, and the House of Lords could reject it twice, but not three times. On the third occasion, it would become law. You might ask a reasonable question. Since the House of Lords had veto power and could reject any bill, why did it not reject this bill? Common sense. They'd be mad, surely, not to. A bill limiting their own powers so drastically. Asquith had a secret weapon, a deal he had struck with the new king, George V, whereby if the House of Lords rejected the Parliament bill, the king would immediately create hundreds of new members of the House of Lords, which was his right, and swamp the Lords. And if there was one thing that the House of Lords valued more than its power, it was its identity, its prestige, its selectivity, its exclusiveness. The idea of hundreds of liberal, socialist, Irish, Catholic members of the House of Lords. There'd be no point in me a lord anymore. Much better agree to lose most of their powers than to dilute their selectivity, their identity. So the Lords, in the summer, that very hot summer of 1911, debated and schemed and intrigued, divided into two factions, the hedgers and the ditchers. The hedgers who would hedge and compromise, the ditchers determined to die in the last ditch. The hedgers won, the Lords surrendered, the Parliament Act became law, Parliament Bill became an act, and Asquith was then free to move on to stage two of his deal with Redmond, introduce a Home Rule Bill which this time could not be blocked by the House of Lords. When he introduced it in April 1912, everybody knew that the Lords would reject it in 1912, and they would reject it again in 1913, and that they could not reject it in 1914, and that when House of Commons passed the Home Rule Bill for the third time, sometime in the summer of 1914, it would become law. And that forms the background to the Home Rule crisis, the greatest political constitutional crisis in Britain since the 17th century, that I'll discuss next week. And it has, of course, enormous implications for and an enormous impact on Ireland.
We hope you enjoyed this History Hub podcast. You can find many other podcasts on our website at historyhub.ie/podcasts.